We try to do everything ourselves. And when we get to the point that someone can do it a lot better than us, then we partner with someone. And that rule has, I think, served us pretty well. It makes us pretty dangerous, I think, to work with as a partner. We very, very rarely bring a partner in, but when we do, we bring them in for the life of the business.
It's the E-commerce Master Plan Podcast, here to help you solve your marketing problems and grow your e-commerce business. Cutting through the hype to bring you inspiration and advice from the e-commerce sector and beyond. Here's your host, Chloe Thomas.
Hello and welcome. It's great to have you here. Thank you for hitting play and choosing to listen to one of our inspiring guests. I have to start this episode with a big thank you to Jamie Villela from Cookie Haircare, who was our guest in episode 531, for introducing us to these brilliant guests. So thank you, Jamie. In this episode, we are exploring a whole range of things with the co-founders of a furniture brand within the soft play category. They'll explain that shortly. We are talking about how they've grown the business over the last 4 years, their decisions to go international, their decisions to keep the team super tiny, how they've gone about growth, how they've gone about category building. Loads of cool stuff coming up in this one. Please make sure you listen to the end of the episode so you don't miss out on my guest top tips, including a super brilliant reducing your return rates piece of advice and my own take on this episode. And now to introduce our special guests, Renee Cizelle and Georgia Rossi from Possum Play. They're sellers of the play sofa that transforms into hundreds of different configurations. Founded in 2021, they now sell internationally via their 3-country-specific Shopify stores, with 40,000 happy families loving the product already. Hello, Renee.
Hi, Chloe. Happy to be here.
Great to have you on the show. And Georgia, hello.
Hi, Chloe.
Awesome to have you both. Loving your product, loving your business. But how did you get into the world of e-commerce?
It was a jiggly journey, I would say. So Renee and I met close to 15 years ago in our first graduate jobs. We were consultants at McKinsey. And after a couple of years there, we left together and launched a technology company in the US. That's sort of the high watermark of being powerful female founders in New York City in our mid-20s. And we ran a business in New York for about 4 or 5 years. After that, we both moved into corporate jobs. And around the same time as each other, we decided that we wanted to work together again. And we wanted to build a business again. And we wanted to do something unlike anything we had done before. And that meant we wanted to not do a VC route. We wanted to start something ourselves, build it ourselves, fund it ourselves. Renee had just become a mum. And we had seen this category of soft play equipment really take off overseas. And we were living in Australia at the time. We were about to go into lockdown. I had just moved home from London, where I had endured a very long lockdown. So I sort of knew what was coming. And we decided to launch a soft play furniture concept in Australia. And that was the birth of the Possum Play Couch. So we started in lockdown in June 2021, and we sold out that year. We literally shipped all of our own products ourselves. We sold containers on the water. We sold out for Christmas. That was really exciting. And then the business sort of really took off the following year. And the year after that, we launched in the UK. And then we've just launched in Europe at the end of last year.
Very cool. So much to get into there. So you're an Australian business. Are you making the product in Australia? And are you organizing all the manufacturing in this instance?
So we get the product manufactured in China. And one of the things that was so fortunate for us is the manufacturer that we found in those early days in 2021 in COVID, when sort of you couldn't travel. They've been an amazing part of our journey and have continued to grow with us. We still manufacture with them today. So we manufacture in China, and then we have distribution 3PL warehouses in Australia, the UK, and very recently in Europe, in the Netherlands.
I suppose it's one of those products where the decision of shall we fulfill ourselves or not is quite easy to make due to its size.
You would think so, Chloe, but you know, we fulfilled, like Georgia was saying, we fulfilled those first containers ourselves.
I've never had better biceps in my life.
It was a humbling experience for us, actually. And I always reflect on how glad I am that we did that, because, you know, our 3PL partners are such an important part of our business now, but we have so much appreciation and respect for sort of what goes into the fulfillment task. I think if we hadn't have done that ourselves, we might have thought, hey, this is really simple. How could you possibly get this wrong? But, you know, those first few containers, we printed every shipping label ourselves, and we packed those, we physically ourselves lifted the sofas off the containers and then put them in with the couriers. And so it's given us a lot of appreciation for our 3PL partners. But yes, whenever we speak to anyone now, we're like, go straight to the 3PL.
And we're, 4 years into the business now, and a lot of D2C brands go pretty crazy on the product range expansion, but you've stayed pretty strictly. I mean, there's colors and there's replacement parts and things, but you've stayed pretty strictly to the pure sofa concept. Has that been an easy decision to make or a difficult one to make?
Yeah, it's funny. We think that our product range has expanded quite a bit because when we started, we literally had 8 SKUs. You know, we had the one sofa with 8 different colorways, and now we have sort of 10 products. We've got another sort of 5 products in the pipeline this year, and we go across 14 different colorways. So we're sort of well over the sort of, by the end of the year, we'll be hitting up around the 200 SKU mark, which makes our demand forecasting, it seems like for us, a lot harder than when we were at that 8 SKU mark. But we've found that, you know, families have loved the Possum, the play sofa, which is our real hero product. And then we've really built out a range of other cushions and accessories and sort of fun furniture to support that. So you're right, we haven't gone really, really deep into the toy category. We've found that we wanted customers to think of us and think of soft play and for us to really own that space.
Got you. And what does your team look like? Who's running this business? So for some reason in my head, whenever I think big product, I assume big team. Am I right? Am I wrong? Is there loads of you or barely anyone at all?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that people find quite surprising. Not the people that know us, who know that Renee and I like to do what we can ourselves, but the team is just Renee and I. And then earlier this year, we hired an operations director. So we took it from a team of 2 to a team of 3 earlier this year. We obviously work with a lot of partners across our marketing and operations channels, but in terms of the core team, it's us.
We also have a customer service team member who's been with us for a few years, and she does a couple of hours flexibly each day, sort of managing our inboxes. And you know, she definitely gets a shout out too, because her
she's doing God's work.
She is. But yeah, in terms of like a traditional like FTE team, there are 3 of us, and then our customer service part time support. Yeah.
And you said there that you like to do a lot of things yourself and keep it in, but you also said you've got lots of partners in the marketing space and that. So how do you decide when you're keeping the official team so tiny, what you're going to do yourselves and what you're going to hire agencies, freelancers, et cetera, to do? What do you have a theory on that, or is it each thing as it comes? How do you work it out?
Yeah, we have refined this not just in this business, but over the businesses that we've run together. And really where we've landed is we try to do everything ourselves. And when we get to the point that someone can do it a lot better than us, then we partner with someone. And that rule has, I think, served us pretty well. It makes us pretty dangerous, I think, to work with as a partner, because we're pretty generalist at this point. It also means that we're fairly protective of our profit margins, and we very, very rarely bring a partner in, but when we do, we bring them in for the good, like for the life of the business, basically. Like, we're still working with our content partner from years ago.
Got you. And is the reason you're keeping the team so tiny that profit margin standpoint, or is it, are there other reasons that go into it?
Not the only reason. I think there's a few reasons, and it's definitely one of them. Another one is Renee and I we have those generalist skills and we really like to do the work and we like to do the work together. So I think we really enjoy our jobs.
I think that this is always a challenge for founders in any business, which is like knowing when to release a little bit of control as well. And I won't pretend that there's probably parts of the business that we should have released a little bit of control of and, you know, gotten some of our time back on. But yeah, so there's probably a little bit of an element of that. But we're constantly having discussions about, could someone be doing this better than us, or could someone doing this give us time to do something else that we should be doing? And, you know, when we hired our operations manager a year ago now, that came off the back of us having a real discussion about saying, hey, we're working really in the business, but struggling to find time to work on the business, that sort of classic founder conundrum. And that was when we brought her in to really help us run day-to-day operations so that we could spend more time thinking strategically about the business. And in doing that, we, you know, launched Europe like an entire new continent by the end of the year with the sort of headspace that freed up for us, and also brought a bunch of new products onto the product pipeline. And those were things that we just couldn't get to because we were really, you know, in the day-to-day of a fairly significantly sized business. So that, not sure that answered your question, Chloe.
No, that definitely did answer the question, because I think it's like there was always that kind of famous thing. I think it was at Amazon where if your team can't be fed by a pizza, you need to split into separate teams, which kind of got quite a lot of airway in the 2000s as a great tip for company manpower management. And it's like, well, actually, hold on a minute. Nothing is that simple. You know, that's like a bit of an oversimplification. But what I love about what you said in your answer there is that I think all of us are going, I've got too much on my plate. How do I, you know, what's the stuff at the bottom that I could get rid of? The admin-y stuff we think of so often. We spend less time, I think, thinking about, I'm doing an okay job of this, but if I outsourced it, could someone do it better? I don't think we think about the quality as much as we think about the drudgy time element of it. So I love that you've taken that. Actually, if someone can do this better, let's outsource it to them. And then if we create a role for someone to look after our ops, then that's going to free us to drive the strategy. And we've then got the resources to make the strategy happen without it falling into that place of, we've had a great idea, but that's just increased my workload by 10%, which can be quite a hold up to it. How easy was it after a few years to bring a third person into the senior team?
It wasn't easy because Georgia and I have worked together for 15 years, and the person who we hired into the role is Georgia's oldest friend. So, you know, that's...
You can see my hiring philosophy.
Keep it close.
Keep it close. Yes, and she is amazing, and we knew her skill set before she joined the team and knew it was such a good fit for us. I think if we had looked really externally to try and hire for that role, it would have been difficult to find someone, particularly because we were looking to, you know, if you're still a three-person business, the person that you're hiring is very likely going to need to be a jack of all trades. And jack of all trades are hard to find. So it's been amazing bringing her into the business. But we knew a lot about her beforehand. But yes, that's also how we've set this business up as well, knowing each other very well.
It's such a lesson in hiring for a transit. Nelly is. That's our employee and friend. Nelly had not done this role before, or really done a role that was similar to it. But she has incredible intrinsics in what would make her successful in this role. And, you know, Renee and I have run really big teams. Like, we've both run teams with hundreds of people in it. And we understand that sometimes your experience doesn't necessarily make you the best person for the job. And actually what it is, and this is I think is really relevant when it comes to hiring women, you can see people's intrinsics, and it may not be their career history, but they will be the best person at the job if you can really get down to the nuts and bolts of what they're good at.
So you mentioned there about, you know, your past work experience again. And I wonder, do you think Possum Play, it's a big question coming here, guys, no apologies for it, but do you think Possum Play would have been as successful, as straightforward to build? Well, not necessarily straightforward, but less challenging to create than it has been because of your previous experience working together to build a SaaS company, your experience in big ticket consulting firms, your experiences running big companies. Is it like all of that and the networks that's given you in terms of, I would assume, advice as well as, you know, knowing the right person to bring into that role when you decided to create it? Do you think you'd have got to where you are now if you hadn't have had all those experiences before?
It's a big question and a great question. And the answer is certainly not. I think that, you know, Renee and I have learned so many things through our career together and through our friendship. But I think the biggest thing that we've learned through multiple of the jobs that we've done is resilience. And anyone will tell you, being an e-commerce founder, particularly at the moment, you need to have a lot of resilience. Like, it is a true roller coaster. And so what our history has taught us, you know, is how to get through those. And it's the strategic planning and it's understanding that things aren't permanent and all of those things. But truly, having done hard things in the past lets us do a hard thing now and have fun whilst we're doing it.
Cool. You mentioned there about resilience, which is definitely critical in the industry at the moment. You've expanded from Australia relatively early in the business into both the UK and into Europe. Was that a decision about growth? Was it a decision about risk mitigation? Was it, this looks challenging and fun, let's give it a go? What was it that led you guys to decide to do that quite so early in the business? And the UK and the Europe expansions, or Europe in particular, is a complicated place to expand into. You've got language. You don't have currency anymore, but you have lots of different, you know, human behavioural elements across the place as well. So what led you to decide to do that when you did?
It definitely wasn't risk mitigation. It was probably risk addiction more than anything. I had lived in the UK. We have run businesses, not just in Australia, but around the world. And Australia is a small place. You know, we had really, really big ambitions for our business and for our lives. And so going international, we wanted to make it big in Australia, which we have. But going international was sort of always something that we had hoped we would be able to do. What we saw was that we could take a concept that was proven in the US and bring it to Australia. And we thought, no reason we can't do that in the UK. A mum like wants the best for their kids, no matter where they are. And so, you know, we knew, having basically created the category in Australia, that we'd have our work cut out for us going to a bigger market like the UK, and now again, an even bigger market in Europe. But once we could create that category, create the awareness and get the product out there, that it would be enormously rewarding, not just financially, but personally. And we really, like, the idea for us that the Possum Play Couch is in 40,000 homes, that there are 40,000 families playing with this toy every day, year after year, is truly, truly, truly rewarding for us. So we just wanted to get it as far and wide as quickly as we could.
The other thing that we would add there is that, you know, we are not a VC-backed business. We're a business that we really back our product. We know once it gets in homes that people love it, that kids come over and they see it in their friend's lounge room and they play with it, but that it takes a little bit of time to spread that word. If you're not going to invest in like a big branding campaign, you're not going to be putting billboards out and then splashing a bunch on Meta ads that you know, that are just brand building and that don't necessarily have an ROI. And so in that way, we knew that time in market matters. You know, the longer that you can give your word of mouth flywheel to sort of start percolating and turning, the easier it will be. And so we always knew that we wouldn't launch markets with these huge budgets. It would be sort of like, how do we get the first, you know, we always talk about like, how do you get that first container of stock, those first 500 sofas into someone's home? And then we were looking at each other and we're like, well, it'd kind of be better to do it this year than next year, right? Because then you've got another year of those sofas out there and then they can sort of grow. And so that really drove our decision to say, well, let's do this as early as we think we can, so that we can get that sort of get into homes and get that word of mouth going as soon as we can.
E-commerce Master Plan is supported by some of the greatest companies in the e-commerce sector. Here's a reminder of who they are. It's time for the top tips round.
Okay, I love this section because it gives me and our listeners some really quick ideas for taking our businesses to the next level. Renee and Georgia, are you ready for the top tips? Okay, Georgia, first off, the book top tip. If everyone listening to this podcast agreed to take Friday off and read a book to make their business better, which book would you recommend?
I would recommend reading anything by Ryan Holiday. He is, I think, the most interesting author on Stoicism, and he talks a lot about resilience.
Oh, I love a recommendation for one of his books. So thank you for that, Georgia. Next up, traffic top tip. Which marketing method do you either prize above all others or think doesn't get the press it deserves?
Look, I am proud to say, I suppose, that we are a meta-driven business. We created the category, and which meant we had to create a lot of category-level awareness. No one had a play couch, let alone a possum play couch, when we launched. And so the possum play couch is an incredibly visual product. And so we rely a lot on photos and videos, which means we sell through Instagram.
Simple as that. And is that organic or influencer or ad-led or all of the above?
Yeah, it's organic and ad-led. We don't do much influencer because we don't do promo codes.
Makes a lot of sense. Okay, Renee, then, the tool top tip. Maybe a collaboration tool, a social media plugin, a phone app, or just a way of working. Is there a cool little tool you use that makes you and your team more efficient from day to day?
Yeah, I think the way of working that we use that's sort of critical for us is a Monday morning meeting. And we, Georgia and I, kick off every week with a coffee and like a really rigorous run through our priorities and what we're going to try and achieve for the week. And, you know, we kind of couldn't function without it, I don't think. So that really helps focus us. And I'd say that the other thing that we add to the Monday morning meeting is, and we have this as like a almost dedicated half of the meeting is like a life catch up. Georgia's laughing because I would have usually seen her on Saturday or Sunday. So we're often like, what's happened to you in the last 12 hours? But, you know, we also use that to just sort of make sure that if there's anything on our life agenda that we need to know about as we're running a business together, it's a check-in on like, you know, whose kids are on school holidays, on like who's, you know, unwell in the family, who is, you know, whatever, what are the other big life things you have going on. That just helps us sort of run the business, not just as business partners, but as people and as friends. And so we have a lot of fun doing that and can strongly recommend a, you know, a double shot coffee to get through it.
It sounds obvious to do that, but I encourage people to pause and think, like, how often do you open your to-do list to your business partner? Like Renee and I have complete transparency over what we're each doing and what we're accountable for. And that is the power of the Monday morning meeting. It's like, what are you doing? Nah, you shouldn't do that. Or I want you to do this.
And it's so easy on a Monday to come in, if you've been switched off over the weekend, especially, and go, right, I need to clear the inbox. I need to clear the inbox. Then all of a sudden it's 2 o'clock on Monday. And you're then fighting your to-do list. And at no point have you gone, hold on, what should I actually be doing this week? And you can turn around and go, oh, well, I did a to-do list on Friday. You know, I'm a good girl. I did my to-do list on Friday, so it's good. It's like, yeah, but the subconscious has done a shed load of work between Friday and Monday,
yeah,
which should, it will inevitably, 50% of the time, have changed your priorities anyway. So I love that recommendation. I might try and do that with myself because I clearly should. Okay, Renee, last question for you. The carbon top tip, what's your favorite way to reduce the carbon footprint of an e-commerce store?
Yeah, we sell a sofa. So it's a big product. And we think a lot about how we can sort of minimize the carbon footprint specifically around shipping. And one of the things that we are pretty adamant about and really focus on is anything that we can do in the selling process to try and minimize returns. Obviously, that's good from a business perspective, but it also just means that you're not shipping a big product back and forth. So one of the things that we really focus on is making sure that the product photos on the website really represent specifically the color of the product, but also try and give insight as to the texture of the product. We have you know, a collection of amazing creators who will take photos of the possum, but sometimes they'll use filters or different lighting. Those photos will never make it on the website. On our website, you will only ever see photos that really look like what the product looks like to try and minimize returns. And then we also offer swatches, which are a way for customers to be able to sort of see the colors in real life, touch the fabric in real life before ordering a sofa and then sort of getting it and saying, oh, this isn't actually what I want. So I think really thinking about how in your website experience you can try and minimize the back and forth shipping. And I feel like a lot of e-commerce businesses don't. They almost encourage returns. And that is, it's not really great for the environment. It's also not a great customer experience. So those two things really bundle together.
Share our return rate.
We have a less than 0.025% return rate. Like, we return very, very, very few possum play catches.
Nice. And congratulations on getting to that. And it's interesting. I think a lot of the time when people hear sustainability and returns, the immediate thought is, you know, slapping fees on it to stop people from buying so much product in the fashion industry, or just telling them to keep it in order to stop it, which doesn't solve the fundamental problem of a return, which is that someone bought the wrong thing in the first place. So I love that your focus is on how can we help people buy the right thing in the first place, which is just makes so much more sense than selling them wrong things and then trying to find ways to manipulate your way out of a shocking situation that you could have dealt with at the beginning. So love that approach. Thank you. So Rinny and Georgia, great to have you on the show. Before we say goodbye, could you please let the listeners know where they can find you and your business on the web and social media?
Yeah. So we are on Instagram and on Facebook, and we are online. Our website is possumplay.com.au in Australia, possumplay.co.uk in the UK, and possumplaycatch.com in Europe.
Very cool. Well, look, Renee, Georgia, thank you so much for sharing so much about your business on the podcast. I know it will have helped the listeners, and an absolute pleasure to chat with you. Good luck for what comes in the rest of 2025.
Thanks so much for having us.
A real pleasure to catch up with Renee and Georgia there. You can only see their business going from strength to strength. They make creating a whole new category and a whole new product and growing it into three different countries, it seems so easy with a team of like three plus one customer service person. So really fascinating to hear about their philosophy and how they go about building that. Now, you can get your hands on the notes from this episode, including those top tips and links to what we've mentioned, by heading over to ecommercemasterplan.com. You can also use our direct episode short links. Just put ecmp.info/ the number of this episode into the URL bar, and you'll be redirected straight to the correct episode page. And when you're there, why not add yourself to our email list so you get all the cool things we share in the e-commerce master plan newsletter? If you liked this episode, then why not check out episode 531, which is where I got to chat to Jamie Villela from Cookie Haircare, who recommended these guests to come on the show. Jamie's episode is getting a lot of listens. I think it's probably almost our most popular this year, just behind our top tips that we did in January. So super popular episode, very much about growth, very much about D2C. So go and have a listen to that one. And if you want more stuff around homewares, head to ecmp.info/home. That will take you to a page on the website where we've brought all of that together. Thank you very much for tuning into this and every episode that you do of the E-commerce Master Plan podcast. I bring you a new interview every week because I want to inspire and help e-commerce business owners like you to succeed and thrive with your businesses, including becoming more sustainable. So if you know someone this show can help, please tell them to listen to the E-commerce Master Plan podcast. I hope you have a great week, and don't forget to keep optimizing.
Thank you for listening to the E-commerce Master Plan podcast. Find out more at ecommercemasterplan.com/podcast.